From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with Eric Hansen about his travels on foot through the rainforests of Borneo. He writes about his adventures in his new book, Stranger in the Forest. Also, a talk with Bill Buford, editor of the literary magazine Granta. Since reviving the magazine a few years ago, Buford has formed it into an eclectic, risk-taking venture. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording featuring British conductor Geoffrey Tate and the English Chamber Orchestra performing Haydn's military symphonies. And humorist Alice Kahn compares television families with real-life relationships. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Eric Hansen describes himself as addicted to travel. He's lived in the Middle East, Asia, and Africa, and has supported himself working as a buffalo catcher, wild dog hunter, and as a barber in Mother Teresa's Home for the Destitute Dying in Calcutta. In 1982, Hansen walked across the rainforests of Borneo. Borneo is the third largest island in the world. It straddles the equator and contains some of the world's last uncharted rainforests. Hansen says that it wasn't until he stood at the very edge of the Sarawak rainforest that he realized he had no idea what he was doing. Over the next 7 months, he learned a lot of things the hard way. Throughout his trip, he kept a journal which he adapted into the new book, Stranger in the Forest, on foot across Borneo. Right now, Hansen is in between adventures and is living in Manhattan. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York and asked him if he knows why he travels.
Travel for me is very much like being able to get into a time capsule and go back to a bygone age. Traveling to Borneo very much was like that. Living with a group of nomadic hunters and gatherers, it's a lifestyle that's totally dying out, a way of living that, you know, doesn't exist in very many parts of the world. And although going to Borneo is just one of many trips I've done, I usually select countries, pre-industrial societies, third world countries, that have something to offer that you don't find in, you know, modern Western societies.
So that's why you chose Borneo, because you're interested in pre-industrial societies.
Yeah, and I knew I'd been there earlier, 1976. I'd made a short visit to Borneo, and I realized that this is one of the last places that I could actually see people who hunted and gathered.
Did you go with a plan, with a set of goals, like I'm going to walk across, you know, this particular jungle on foot, so that if you have goals, then you know when it's time to go home?
Well, you know what I mean?
Then you know when the trip has come to an end?
Well, it was hard to tell when the trip was going to come to an end. My preconceived notions were that I would be able to actually acquire the jungle skills necessary to cross the island by myself. But in the course of the first 2 months, I realized that I would be totally dependent on the local people. And I think the book and the journey is my experiences of changing the game plan constantly. I was generally headed, you know, west to east. But apart from that, I had very little control over where I was going each day and how I would spend my time. And that, I think, in the end was the most beneficial part of the trip. I completely put my safety and how would I put it? I just sort of put myself in the hands of total strangers, the people who live in the jungle. And being able to release control over my life in that way for literally 7 months was, I think, looking back on it, the best part of the trip.
You're a seasoned traveler. Did you nevertheless go to Borneo with a set of movie images and fantasies that you had from, Smithsonian Magazine and National Geographic and things like that?
Not really. I think what I wanted to do was so many trips, certainly people who climb mountains and do these whitewater trips, it's sort of the theme is man versus nature. My attitude towards this trip was being much more passive, learning from my experiences, immersing myself in the unknown. And so I wasn't trying to dominate the environment that I was in, or dominate even the guides that I took with me. They were very much part of the decision-making process every day. So I don't think that National Geographic or any sort of adventure travel fantasies actually had that much to do with the journey.
How did you find your guides? You described how you put yourself in their hands. But it was hard for you to find guides, wasn't it, when you got there?
Well, the difficult thing was that I had no idea what it would be like traveling in the jungle. And once I got in there, I realized why people hesitated taking me, because I was a man, but I couldn't hunt. Their definition of a man is a hunter, and so I would be looked upon as being totally useless. Like, I would be, you know, excess baggage. I assumed that if I, you know, learned enough language and was healthy enough, anybody would take me into the jungle. But it's such a difficult environment to travel through, the tropical rainforest, that I was literally a liability of these people. I had to prove that I could actually, you know, carry my own weight and contribute to the journey.
So how'd you find your guides?
Well, I found them sort of by dumb luck. I was stuck in a village, and I had tried, oh, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 times to get into the interior. And finally, I just, you know, let word get out that I was interested in having guides. Instead of paying money, I was offering shotgun shells, which are illegal in Sarawak. And people were tempted by the shotgun shells. I think that's mainly why they took me on the first leg of the journey.
It was interesting to me that your guides had never seen maps before. You were spreading out your maps and trying to get a sense of, you know, which river crosses which part of the jungle. And they couldn't comprehend a map at all and started, like, scratching patterns out into the dirt to show you what the lay of the land was.
Well, how they find their way through the rainforest, because there's such limited visibility, they have memorized all the river systems and all the little streams. They're very well aware of the watersheds and the ridges. To them, maps are totally useless. They'll follow a trail only as long as the hunting is good or their fruit trees to be found. They would never hike in a straight line from point A to point B, which is how most Westerners travel. And that's one thing that I had to get used to, was that maybe we are headed, you know, south or east, but we may, you know, walk in the opposite direction for much of the time, and in fact walk in circles.
I'm speaking with Eric Hansen, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, Stranger in the Forest, on foot across Borneo. You describe how after a while you came to see every step in the jungle as being potentially dangerous. What were some of the things that you did that made you realize how dangerous each step you took could be?
Well, what I didn't realize before I started the trip was how difficult it is to walk in the jungle. What I thought would be a journey where I would walk 10 or 15 miles a day turned into a journey where I might walk for 10 hours in a day, and I might make 2 miles of progress if I was lucky. Looking at a map, I'd think, oh, well, if I, you know, sprained my ankle or if I hurt myself, I'd only be 50 miles from, you know, the nearest village. Well, 50 miles from the nearest village in the rainforest might be a month's journey if the terrain is bad. It wasn't until I actually got into the rainforest and actually sprained my ankle at one point that I thought, this is all that it would take for me, you know, to end up dying in the rainforest because I wouldn't be able to get out.
You know, when you wrote that in your book, that when you sprained your ankle, you realized how vulnerable you were, I was kind of shocked because I was thinking all along, hey, this guy's going to be really vulnerable in that rainforest. You know,
uh-huh.
It doesn't, I just don't understand how someone could be so immune to that feeling of vulnerability.
Well, I think to take on a journey like the one I did, I had to be hopelessly optimistic about.
Really?
I mean, if I'd thought about it, I wouldn't have done the trip.
There's one point where on one day you took 100 leeches off your right leg, and then you didn't even count how many you took off your left. Doesn't that get discouraging?
Well, that's one thing I just had to get used to. Usually, there'll always be leeches on the trail. You'd always get a dozen or so in a day. But they're particularly bad right after it rains. The first hour or so after there's been a rainfall, the leeches just come. I don't know where they come from, but the trails are thick with them. And I would, you know, continue to pick them off all day. But it's just another thing I had to get used to. I mean, I don't think I like leeches more than anyone else. They're totally painless, but just the idea of the small little creature sucking your blood, I just had to, you know, adapt my thoughts to it.
When one travels as much as you do, then you're always in the position of feeling somewhat incompetent because, for instance, traveling through the jungle, you're with guides who basically live in the jungle and really know what they're doing. And you're a novice. You really don't. What's it like for you to always willingly put yourself into positions like this one, where you know you're going to be kind of incompetent, at least for a while, until you've learned something about the environment?
Well, I mean, you have to be very humble to do a trip like this.
Mm-hmm.
Many people that, go on adventures, they climb mountains, whatever, they usually, do the trip. When the trip's over, funny thing, the guides were never mentioned. In Stranger in the Forest, I try to make it very clear that I could not have done this trip without the local people. I had incredible respect for their skills. I don't think I really am the sort of person that has to be the local expert. I wasn't there to tell people what to do or where to go. I didn't feel like I was, in charge of an expedition. I was there to learn from the local people. They were the experts, and I had no illusions from the very beginning, or at least any illusions I had got knocked out of me, very early on in the trip, that I would actually be orchestrating the trip. I completely surrendered the decision-making and gave it to the local people.
Although you were the stranger in this culture, although everything in the culture was strange to you, you were the stranger to the people who actually live in Borneo, and you got some very interesting reactions to your presence. When you first got there, you said that you felt like people were treating you like a walking dollar sign.
Well, and for obvious reasons, this is, that part of the book was in Sarawak, and a lot of people have visited Sarawak and tried to get up the rivers, and in many of these isolated communities, there are very few opportunities to actually make money, and when, a total stranger shows up who doesn't really know what's going on, doesn't know the ropes, it wants to be guided or rent, a longboat or be helped. I think it's just human nature to, charge more than the going rate, and that was part of the learning process for me. I mean, I didn't appreciate it when it was happening, but that was, the way I learned how people behaved in Borneo.
Toward the end of your trip, you found that there was one community of people who were very frightened by you, and you learned that that's because that they thought you might be the Black Ghost. Would you explain that?
Yeah, that's a very long story, but just very briefly, the people in Kalimantan being the southern two-thirds of the island of Borneo, they have there's a traditional part of the year called the Season of Fear, which corresponds with what was originally the headhunting season. And during that period of the year, they're very frightened, and there are omens about spirits visiting their community. And one of the spirits is called Bali Salang, which is Kenya for the Black Ghost. Well, just by coincidence, the year that I arrived in Kalimantan, in this particular river valley, there was an omen that a tall, fair-skinned, brown-haired stranger would walk over the mountains from Sarawak and visit the valley to collect sacrificial blood. And I, right on cue, walked over the mountains, entered the valley, and everybody assumed that this, I'd fulfilled the omen. And it took about 5 or 6 weeks to convince people that I was actually, totally innocent. I was not collecting sacrificial blood. I go into this story in some detail in the book, but the problem was that I felt that with my language skills that I could talk myself out of any potentially dangerous situation. But what I didn't realize was the way that I was thinking was what was getting me in trouble. They were thinking of black magic, omens, superstitions, and I was totally ignoring that. I was sort of working from a Western viewpoint of logic and, reasoning. And they just could not accept, me saying, oh, no, you have nothing to worry about.
What are some other instances where the kind of Western logic and reasoning that you are used to didn't work and you had to find another way of operating?
Oh, there was another case where I was in a village and I'd suspected guides for the previous few weeks of taking me a longer way than they had to so that they would get, more wages from me. And in one case, somebody said, oh, we're going to go from here to the next.
It's like a bad taxi cab driver,
Exactly. No, exactly. And in this one case, somebody said, oh, we can't go down that valley because there's a dragon cave down there. And I thought, right, a dragon cave. And there is a folk story or a local belief that there is a dragon that inhabits this particular valley and people do not walk down the valley. And I tried to hire people to take me down there because I wanted to check out the story. And in the end, I realized that these people were frightened, and they'd had this belief for about 150 years, and there's no way they were going to take me to that area. And I think that was a real crucial point in the trip, because I thought, okay, maybe I don't believe in dragons. They do. I'm going to respect their fears. We're not going to go down that valley. So we took a 10-day detour around this valley. And I think that was the local people seeing that I was accepting their beliefs helped me penetrate their culture more. They thought, okay, here's another outsider, but at least he's respecting us, our fears, our superstitions. So many local experts come in there, the missionaries, the logging people, the geologists, and they have no respect for the local beliefs.
Well, that's an interesting thing about respecting the beliefs, because I think in Western culture that we've cast certain beliefs and certain rituals in this real, like, ooga-booga kind of way.
Oh, exactly.
You know? And so it's so easy to go down to a place like that with all these preconceptions and with a real ooga-booga mentality. Was it... you were brought up in the same culture I was with all that kind of stuff. Is it hard to just disassociate yourself from those kinds of stereotypes?
No, because I've traveled in similar countries where, you know, the people are fit the stereotypical image of, you know, the black man saying ooga booga. I think we're all brought up on the Little Rascals.
The spear-chucking natives.
Exactly. And the thing is that people, they look at people in places like Borneo and they say, aren't they primitive? Well, if you take those, if you took somebody out of that environment and put them on a park bench or in an office in Manhattan, yeah, they'd be very primitive. They'd be totally incapable of dealing with their surroundings. Just as if you took, some businessman off the street of Manhattan and put him in the jungle, they'd say, isn't this guy primitive? He can't do anything. You know, he can't feed himself. He can't, you know, walk 100 yards without getting lost. The people in Borneo, they have a very highly developed sense of how to move through their environment. They have very sophisticated belief systems.
But how do you deal with belief systems like sacrificial blood?
Well,
it's
I don't know.
A pretty alien concept to Western culture.
I'm sure there are equivalents here of, groundbreaking ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of any off the top of my head.
Is there anything you walked away from Borneo thinking, but this is totally incomprehensible to me?
Oh, most of it. No, I've had no illusions. No illusions about, being an expert on Borneo. I was lost most of the time, totally disoriented. I've collected a lot of funny stories about people in a pre-industrial society in the rainforest looking at the 20th century. Their lifestyle made about as much sense to me as my lifestyle did to them. I tried to explain what a subway is or what a street is or what an automobile is. And it's just, they had no idea.
I want to talk with you more about your trip to Borneo, but first we're going to take a short break. Eric Hansen is my guest, and he has traveled through many deserts and jungles. He's written a new book about his trip on foot across Borneo. It's called Stranger in the Forest. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Eric Hansen is my guest. You know, you were talking about funny stories you had collected about 20th century technology ending up in strange places within Borneo. And the first jungle dweller that you met had a transistor radio and heated up the batteries by the fire thinking it would help make them more powerful.
Well, actually it does. I don't know why.
Does it really?
You can heat up the batteries and for about 5 minutes or so. If the batteries are wearing out, if you heat them up for some reason, it will sort of activate them for a few minutes, and then they'll, when they cool down, they die away again.
How do you like that? And then there was another instance that was really interesting where a cassette player was used by mourners.
Yeah, what happened? It's funny how they're adapting these, gadgets of the 20th century. Traditionally, in Kalimantan, once again, the Kenya are one of the tribal groups, and they have a sort of different social rankings within their village communities. If somebody who's the equivalent of an aristocrat there dies, traditionally you'll have 3 days of mourning, and you stay up all night, and there's a lot of crying and sort of, you know, public statements by people. And, you know, of course, it's very exhausting. Like the second or third night, people are very, very tired. But the departing spirit has to be honored by the sounds of mourning. So I witnessed this one wake or funeral where they recorded like the first day of mourning and the first night of mourning. So they had several hours of this on cassette tape. And on the second or the third night, people wanted to sleep, but they didn't want to offend the departing spirit. So they turned on the tape, and whenever it ran out, somebody would get up, rewind it, and then put it on play again. And they felt that this totally would satisfy the spirits.
It's a really interesting story. Now, you would occasionally run into other travelers when you were traveling, and you describe in your book the kind of one-upsmanship that requires that all travelers outdo each other with stories.
Absolutely.
Did this happen to you a lot in Borneo?
The time I mentioned in Borneo was running into this man who had a sewing machine on his back that he had carried, I think it was about 100 miles through the jungle.
Did you look at him and think, what a nut?
No, I thought, this is fantastic. I saw him, and my first instinct was, this guy has got an incredible story, and I want it. And but, of course, it made me feel like my own journey was a sort of, you know, self-indulgent, you know, bourgeois adventure. You know, white man goes into the jungle, and I thought, there are much, much better stories here than, you know, the one that I'm making for myself.
Well, what was he doing with a sewing machine? Was he a tailor sewing his way through the jungle?
Well, that occurred to me. But what he was doing in the course of his explanation, he had spent 2 years, he had hiked from the center of Borneo down to the coast of Sarawak on the north shore of Borneo, and had worked in a horrible job in this gravel pit, saved enough money, and his wife had wanted a sewing machine, so he went downriver, bought her the sewing machine, and he was just on the return leg of the journey, which had taken, I think, about, it was about 700 miles, and it had taken nearly 2 years for him to do this. But he, you know, within a few days would be back in his village with his sewing machine for his wife.
When you're traveling, do you ever meet any lost souls on the road, people who are traveling because they don't feel comfortable anywhere, and there's no place they really want to be or get to, so they just kind of wander around?
Other Westerners?
Yeah, or any people from other cultures, too, just kind of aimlessly on the road.
No, I think they're sort of the aimless wanderers, and I was one for several years. But I think those people mainly come from Western societies. They have the luxury of time, money, to be able to wander. Nobody from a third world country would be able to wander around as Westerners do. I tend to think it's a travel style, though, that's really dying out. It's something that was common and actually was, you know, quite pleasurable late 60s, early 70s. But I think that style of traveler has pretty much disappeared.
Well, it seems to me you're becoming the kind of traveler now that you have a book under your belt, who travels, finds out all kinds of interesting things, and then writes it from a first-person perspective. What do you think the difference in perspective is that you bring as a travel writer than, say, an anthropologist or a journalist would have brought to their trip to Borneo?
Well, in terms of an anthropologist, I think I give a much more personal account of my journeys. I also traveled for about, 15 years before I wrote a single thing. And so I'm not collecting research to prove any theory or to work on, you know, I'm not trying to develop a thesis of any sort. I'm writing very much about the everyday human being in strange cultures for, you know, the average reader, you know, in the Western world. I know a lot of researchers, they may love traveling, but they always feel like they have to justify their trips by working, you know, on some project. I've never felt that need. The journeys that I've done have always been, you know, the reward. I haven't had to, you know, come up with some finished product. In terms of journalism, there are several travel writers who always are the observers. They actually don't mingle with the local people. And I think because the main reason I travel is because I love people and I love mingling with them, you know, the local people, learning the language. Nothing is too crazy a suggestion when I'm on one of these trips. I'll literally do anything
That's the impression I got.
Yeah, I mean, some of those party scenes and dance scenes, I mean, it's like nothing is better for me than to actually blend in and, you know, sort of enjoy people the way they, you know, traditionally enjoy themselves. But I do try to, I think how the writing differs from other travel books is that instead of having the sort of the feeling that, oh, aren't I a great writer? Too bad you couldn't have been along on the trip. I very much try to take the reader with me, and the book unfolds just the way the journey unfolded for me, this starting in total ignorance, totally naive of the of my destination, and gradually I introduce the reader and give them the experience of actually going to Borneo and doing all the walking.
Now that you're living in New York, can you apply any of the things that you learn as a traveler? I mean, do you relate to people in New York in the same way that you would if you were starting entering a new culture? Can you apply any of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I can't say that of every city in the United States, but certainly New York is such a place that you really have to have your eyes, your ears open. It's a place that doesn't, I mean, you just can't be mediocre here. You have to be good at what you do. And you just have to, you know, be alert. And certainly that those are the most important things when traveling in the rainforest. It's funny, there are actually a lot of similarities.
When you were in the rainforest and you would take out your journal to write notes in it, because I know you kept a journal while you were traveling, did you ever feel kind of absurd?
Quite often. Well, see, the people in Borneo, they pride themselves in being great storytellers. And whenever I'd pull the journal out, there would be snickers and they would just laugh because they assumed I was writing things down because I didn't have a good enough memory. For them, they can tell stories that are 100 years old that their grandfathers had taught them, and they know the stories perfectly. And so I didn't mind them making fun of me, but they just assumed that I had a poor memory.
One last thing before we run out of time. Did you have to do anything to protect your journal? Were there times when when you had to go to extremes to protect the journal?
No, certainly not from the local people, but coming out of...
No, I mean from the environment, too.
From the environment? No, not really. A couple of times I was in longboats that capsized, but I always had my journals wrapped up in plastic. It was actually coming through customs when I left the country that I was worried that something, you know, they might be taken from me.
So what's your next trip?
Well, my next trip, I'm going to do a similar journey through the mountains of North Yemen, and my interest was... raised in North Yemen. I was there in 1978, and I was wrecked on a sailboat off the coast and got thrown in jail for 10 days.
God, and you keep going back for more.
Well, that's great. I like finishing stories. Like, I get this little taste, and then I want to, you know, go back and actually have a, you know, in-depth look at the countries. So that's what I'll do in North Yemen later this year.
Are you the kind of person who always wants to be someplace else other than where you are?
No, I like moving around, and I consider, I don't think in terms of being an American citizen, I think of myself as being a citizen of the world, and I just, you know, I love moving around.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your travels with us. Thank you for being here.
Great, thank you.
My guest has been Eric Hansen, who is a traveler and has written a new book about his travel through Borneo. It's called Stranger in the Forest, On Foot Across Borneo. It's just been published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with writer John Updike, who has a new novel titled S. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with Bill Buford, editor of Granta, a literary magazine that offers journalism, criticism, and fiction. The magazine has printed the work of such writers as Raymond Carver, Milan Kundera, and Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz takes a look at the career of British conductor Geoffrey Tate. And humorist Alice Kahn reflects on how different real life is from what she sees on television. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. A federal grand jury today indicted four figures in the Iran-Contra scandal. Former National Security Advisor John Poindexter, former National Security Council staffer Oliver North, retired Major General Richard Secord, and Iranian-born businessman Albert Hakim. They are all charged with conspiring to defraud the U.S. government. The four are charged in connection with the illegal scheme to sell arms to Iran and divert the profits from those sales to the Nicaraguan Contra rebels. Honduran government officials say thousands of Nicaraguan troops have massed along their common border, but they would not confirm White House claims that Sandinista forces have invaded Honduras. Despite conflicting reports today from Central America, the Reagan administration insists that an invasion took place, but says no decisions have been made on a U.S. response. NPR's Brian Naylor has details.
The administration says that 1,500 Nicaraguan troops staged the invasion yesterday. Here's President Reagan.
The information we have is that Nicaragua has crossed the border into Honduras.
Are you considering using U.S. troops, introducing them in combat, sir?
We've been in consultation with the Honduran government, and I can't comment on anything now.
There are some 1,200 U.S. forces inside Honduras and about 850 National Guard members. Officials say no options have been ruled out by the administration short of an invasion of Nicaragua. Contra leaders say the Nicaraguan action is designed to weaken the rebels' position in advance of ceasefire talks, which are set to resume next week. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater charged Nicaraguan leader Daniel Ortega with, quote, using the peace process as a cover for militarily destroying the freedom fighters. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
On Capitol Hill, Secretary of State George Shultz, National Security Advisor Colin Powell, and White House Chief of Staff Howard Baker met congressional leaders today to discuss the situation on the Honduran border. After the meeting, Wright said Nicaraguan Foreign Minister Miguel Descoto had assured him that Nicaraguan troops have been ordered to move well inside the Nicaraguan border. Dissident military officers in Panama City today led an unsuccessful rebellion against the regime headed by General Manuel Noriega. The coup attempt was put down by soldiers loyal to Noriega. NPR's Tom Jelton has details.
The leader of the military rebellion was Colonel Leonidas Macias, the chief of the Panama City Police. He was joined by four other officers. Macias had been considered a loyal Noriega ally. When Panamanian President Eric Arturo Del Valle attempted to fire Noriega 3 weeks ago, Colonel Macias was one of the first military officers to condemn Del Valle and defend Noriega. The five officers are reportedly in custody at this hour. According to a Defense Forces communique, no one was injured in the coup attempt, which was put down quickly. Asked about reports from witnesses that shots had been heard inside the barracks, Noriega said, quote, they were kisses, unquote. But the troubles at the barracks kept police from responding to widespread street demonstrations across Panama City today. For much of the morning, streets all over the center of the city were blocked by flaming barricades, and looters attacked several stores. In Panama City, I'm Tom Jelton.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir and President Reagan were unable to reach agreement today on a U.S. plan for peace in the Middle East. Shamir, whose opposition to the plan has remained unchanged by his visit to Washington, said today that he did welcome the U.S. efforts.
Israel has welcomed the American involvement and the sector's efforts in this search. We have confidence in the American role because we share the same goal of peace with security for all the countries in the Middle East.
In Israel today, troops reportedly killed four Palestinians in violent demonstrations on the West Bank. The killings would raise to at least 97, the Palestinian death toll in the uprising. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. 44-year-old British conductor Jeffrey Tate is just completing an American tour with the English Chamber Orchestra. He's led the orchestra since 1985 and is the first permanent conductor the orchestra has had in its 25-year history. This is one of the many extraordinary achievements in Tate's brief career. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has this review of a new recording of Jeffrey Tate conducting the English Chamber Orchestra.
Listening to Jeffrey Tate's recent recording of two late Haydn symphonies, you'd never guess his painful history of physical deformities. He's been crippled since birth with spina bifida, acute scoliosis, and a partially paralyzed right leg. In fact, his first profession was medicine. But these performances have an effortless buoyancy that speaks only of easy grace and mobility. I first heard him and noticed him on the telecast of the Met's Centennial Gala. He conducted the Papageno-Papagena scene from Mozart's Magic Flute, and he was one of very few musicians that night who played his music with the right style, with any style at all. Then I heard him again on a Met tour, conducting an elegant performance of Mozart's Così fan tutte. It didn't surprise me to learn that he had been assistant to Pierre Boulez for the famous production of Wagner's Ring at Bayreuth. The Met orchestra played with a similar sense of clarity and balance. Not everything I've heard him do since has been equally good. Many people are impressed with his Mozart symphony recordings, but I find them a little mannered and slightly enervated. He's doing a series of Mozart concertos with Mitsuko Uchida, and the ones I've heard are gorgeous but somewhat soulless. Yet these Haydn symphonies are special. Here's the moment near the beginning of the exquisite Military Symphony, number 100. Where the slow introduction dissolves into the delectable allegro. Haydn's music is so much less complex, or at least so much less ambiguous than Mozart's. It's puzzling that so few conductors get him right. They either make the music too heavy or too lightweight and trivial. But like the great 18th century poets, Haydn's music is a perfect, inextricable blend of seriousness and wit. Its sparkle comes from being deeply cultured and knowing about life, and knowing in what ways art is different from and better than life. And that's just the balance Jeffrey Tate gets in these Haydn performances. These two symphonies in a bellicose vein, the Military and the Drum Roll, alternate between the charm of toy soldiers and the solemnity of real war. The opening of the Drum Roll has the ominous weight and power of the Day of Judgment music of a Requiem Mass. The drum roll, however, shows a certain Mozartian uncertainty. Listen to this passage from what you'd expect to be a purely charming minuet. Perhaps Tate's greatest achievement is the gracious elegance of a movement like the Allegretto from the Military Symphony, a movement that began life 8 years earlier as a romanza for two hurdy-gurdies and was one of Haydn's greatest hits in his own lifetime. Tate plays it without condescension and with a touching element of gravity. Pleasure, Papa Haydn tells us, is also a serious business.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed a recent recording of two Haydn symphonies, the Military Symphony and the Drum Roll Symphony, performed by the English Chamber Orchestra under the direction of Geoffrey Tate. This is Fresh Air. Bill Buford was a brash young American when he arrived at Cambridge University in England in 1977 to study English. He soon became bored with his classes and turned to reviving a floundering 90-year-old undergraduate magazine called Granta. Under his direction, Granta became one of the most influential and best-selling literary magazines in England. In 1985, Viking Penguin began publishing Granta in this country. Bill Buford describes Granta as a magazine with a mission.
What I'm trying to do with Granta is create a magazine that somebody likes to be in as a reader, something that repays the effort of reading. We're not trying to distinguish literary writing from any other kind of writing. It's just, if it's distinguished, it's distinguished for its seriousness, or it's distinguished for its ambition, or it's distinguished for what it's trying to get across, or it's distinguished for the complex ways in which it's engaging a reader. But it's not distinguished because it's literary.
So this means that you would consider things like travel writing, journalism, short stories, all under the umbrella of what you'd publish.
So that ostensibly one could look into the magazine and find a generic mishmash of interview, document, autobiography, memoir, fiction, politics, polemic, all within the same issue. And actually, I would like to think with an element of coherence running through all the pieces.
Give me an example of one or two pieces that made you think, this is really the kind of stuff I want to be putting out.
One of the most exciting things was publishing the British journalist and poet James Fenton, who sometime before Marcos even mentioned that he wanted to have an election, said that he would like to go to the Philippines because the place was exotic and strange. And we were very enthusiastic and sent him there. And he arrived, as it turns out, the week before the elections, was there during the elections, disappeared between the elections and what followed afterwards to spend some time with the guerrillas, watching war videos on a Betamax in the jungle with them, eating Dunkin' Donuts and returning for the Snap Revolution, and writing very, very quickly what in fact was a book that we brought out several weeks after the end of that revolution. But it wasn't a novel. It was a piece of reportage. But it also illustrated what I think is perhaps our biggest editorial contribution, and one that we've stumbled upon largely accidentally, but one of the most exciting, which is an area that I sometimes describe as narrative journalism.
You're interested in literature that has some kind of political content to it, political teeth to it. Say it has a political message that you don't endorse. Would that hold you back?
I don't know. There's some things we publish that I don't wholly endorse. I have been criticized for publishing really stuff that fundamentally I do endorse.
Liberal, radical,
or
toward
just,
the left.
Just if I read it, I would sort of like it or agree with it.
Okay.
I mean, to put it in its most elemental. It's interesting to get into to having pieces that are taking apart communism in the East and that pieces that are taking apart, that are sort of taking apart the politics of Central America at the same time next to each other, and they're starting to open up issues and starting to open up issues about how you think about the left and how you think about resistance and how you think about whatever the dominant political culture is. But there is, on the whole, probably a coherent, something of a coherent political sensibility in the magazine.
Granta existed long before you became its editor. Give us a short history of the magazine.
Well, its first issue came out in 1889, and it was loosely associated with the university ever since then, taking on a number of different forms from generation to generation, being at some points a kind of boys' school magazine, at some point something like Punch, at something like Private Eye. It got very literary at one point, was publishing Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath and A.A. Milne and E.M. Forster. Ran into financial difficulties at the end of the 60s, early 70s, when two students, Colin McCabe and Stephen Heath, produced an elegant issue devoted to structuralism called Signs of the Times, which the treasurer could see they couldn't possibly pay for, and he pocketed all the money and went to Paris with his girlfriend, and the magazine ceased publishing. Resumed sometime after that in a moribund mimeograph format with staples in the spine when I arrived in Cambridge with the ludicrous idea of doing an issue devoted to American writing.
Okay, so you had no track record as an editor.
No.
Granta had become a magazine that was mimeographed and stapled together. How did you get writers to submit their writing to you for this new American writing edition?
One limited thing we were offering to a number of American writers was a limited British audience. And
it's hard for American writers to reach British readers.
To cross
readers.
The Atlantic. I wrote 22 authors, pretty long, detailed letters in each case, expecting two replies, and got 19 manuscripts, which presupposed...
What did you write to them?
About their work and why I liked their work and why we wanted to publish it and what we hoped to do in publishing it and what we hoped to do in the magazine. And we got so many manuscripts in return that we had to publish the magazine in more or less its current format, even though we were completely clueless about how to do it. And the first issue looks like it was, its design was inspired by a telephone directory. And its printing was the cheapest possible printing, with the result that when it was reprinted, it started to disintegrate. And any copy of that issue now is mainly all black inside.
You know, a lot of fairly famous writers are very famous writers. If they want to help out a new magazine, will send their lesser pieces of work, the pieces of work that the very famous, high-paying magazines won't be interested in. Did that ever happen to you, that a writer who you really liked and respected sent you something that you knew was of inferior quality for what they were capable of doing?
We've lost some friends, invariably, as one would. But you've just got to be as true as you can. I mean, in the early days, I think I would be... the early days, it was rather fun, because in the early days, the magazine was really just me and my friend Pete DiBala, who's now an English academic and, in fact, tenured. And I would go out and meet people and meet writers and be charmed by them and love them and adore them and drink pints of beer with them and come back with a manuscript in my pocket and barely able to read it on the train. But by the time I got back to Cambridge, I would say, got to publish it. And then Pete, sober, antisocial, short, squat, real misogynist, would look at it and go, it's awful. It's awful. What's the matter with you? It's appalling. And somehow Pete's rigid antisocial standards actually established probably the standard of the magazine more than anything else, which is that he refused to meet people and insisted on judging everything solely on the basis of what he saw on the page, which is remarkably effective and was probably the best editorial education that I ever had.
You're trying to publish pieces by fairly well-known writers and also to discover fairly new writers. Are you trying to be a literary scout in a way? Do you see that as being part of your role?
No, not at all.
Why not?
Because we are not, well, because we're not altruistic. it's not a charity, and it's not a scouting agency. What we're trying to do is come up with something that entertains us and hope that it entertains the people that buy the magazine. And that means something that's going to be fresh and new and doing something that someone else hasn't done. Invariably, that means that there will be quite a few well-known writers in the magazine. But actually, in fact, it means that there are quite a few unknown writers in every magazine. And they probably make up half to three-quarters of the contents of the magazine.
Are you a writer yourself?
I am writing. I am writing a book that was due a month ago that I'll have to be completed very shortly, which was based, I suppose, again, in the same narrative tradition, the same journalist tradition, based on Mike's time running around with English soccer hooligans. It's American's first-person account entitled Among the Thugs. It's mainly my time with the thugs of Manchester United.
Can you edit your own writing?
Probably not. But one great virtue of being the editor of a magazine that publishes some very good writers is that you can exploit their good time as they've exploited yours. And I trust I'm being edited by about 50 literary geniuses before my book ever sees print. So I'm sure it's going to be saved by all my friends. And if it fails, it'll be entirely their fault.
Of course. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Yes.
Bill Buford is the editor of Granta Magazine. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
Are you wrapping up Dan Zwerdling's series of reports on the Zenith televisions?
Right, Terry. We'll have the final report tonight on charges that Zenith televisions made in the late 1970s and early 80s have broken into flames, causing household fires and in some cases killing people. Tonight we hear how Zenith has tried to keep facts about the fire controversy from the public. Also tonight, hope for a new treatment for childhood diabetes. French scientists have found a drug that's effective in preventing the body from rejecting organs in organ transplants. Also allows most diabetic children in a study they did to stop using insulin for up to a year.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. All of us lead fantasy lives, which respond to what we don't have in our real lives. Our desires and dreams are frequently inspired by what we see on television. Commentator Alice Kahn has these thoughts on how her real life conflicts with a TV version.
Remember those episodes on Moonlighting where Maddie was confused? So she flew home and walked into her parents' house and said, "This place never changes." This really made me hate Maddie. It wasn't enough that she looked like Sybil Shepherd. It wasn't enough that Bruce Willis and Mark Harmon had the hots for her. I didn't even care that she had her own business, a house, and a BMW. What really grabbed me were those two living, attractive parents, and they lived in a place called home. My father died in 1964, before I was out of my teens. My mother died 10 years ago. The place I called home for the first 13 years of my life was an apartment building located in what is today one of Chicago's prime underclass neighborhoods. It burnt to the ground several years ago. Unlike TV, the place has really changed. Ever since my mother died, I've been aware of a strong streak of self-pity that could be aroused any time people my age talk about their parents or going home. I may have been in my 30s when it happened, but there seems to be a part of me that will never get over being orphaned. I can really make myself jealous if I see a woman my age out with someone who appears to be her mother or her father. One night, I sat next to such a duo at a restaurant. The mother had a beautiful tan and was wearing hand-woven artsy-craftsy clothes. She probably has an adobe house in Santa Fe where her daughter can come and stay anytime she wants. An acquaintance once started to tell me about her parents going on a skiing vacation. I imagine them, 75, in love, not looking a day over 68, still sending their daughter wonderful presents, cookware from Paris, blouses from Guatemala, jewelry from Mexico, maple sugar from Canada, money from Switzerland. I started to hate the woman. But the truth is, most people I know with living parents are not enjoying their parents' old age. They're dealing with the pain of moving their parents out of places they once called home. They're dealing with the long, slow goodbye of Alzheimer's. They're dealing with helping their parents cope with the loneliness of widowhood. They're looking at the enormous medical costs of cancer therapy. They're facing the guilt of nursing homes. Every day, they're caught in a conflict between duty and escape. All that is memory for me. Flying home directly to the hospital, seeing the accelerating effects of aging and disease, hearing words like malignant, metastases, inoperable, and realizing where they ultimately led. So now I'm left with envy of TV characters who can come out of their old rooms late at night in an unchanging place called home and silently cuddle by the fire in the arms of an eternally vigorous father. What really galls me in all this is the certain knowledge that had my parents lived, we would still be as we were, fighting the same old conflicts to the death. I don't envy Maddie Hayes because of the people I lost. I envy her for what TV characters don't need, what I had to find out for myself. I fought growing up tooth and nail, but here I am, ready or not.
Ellis Kahn is a syndicated columnist living in Berkeley, California. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with Jean LePere. While touring Turkey, she bought a carving from a street vendor, but when she was about to leave the country, she was detained on charges of smuggling out an archaeological artifact. We'll hear about her 3 weeks in jail and her escape from Turkey. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review Naked, the long-awaited album from the Talking Heads. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review DOA, a 24 hours left to live thriller starring Dennis Quaid and Meg Ryan. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Deborah Beagle, Warren Kozak, and Fred Landerl. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Lisa Bruton directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.